Den här podden gör jag tillsammans med Mindfulness-appen. Jag är så enormt stolt över det här partnerskapet. För att lära sig vara närvarande i vardagen så är det ett hjälpsamt verktyg att just ha Mindfulness-appen när man ska hantera stress och förbättra sin sömn. Och jag skulle vilja tipsa om hur jag gör för att få in vanan att meditera. Ibland kommer jag av mig, men när jag får in rutin på det så gör jag det verkligen löpande. Och det jag gör då det är att jag mediterar samma tid och på samma plats varje dag. Börja hellre med någon minut varje dag istället för en längre stund och kom in i rutinen och öka sen därefter längden på meditationen. Det har i alla fall funkat för mig. Så jag tycker verkligen att ni ska gå in och testa Mindfulness-appen, för det finns så mycket att välja på där.
Välkommen till min podd Nyfiken på. Här får jag chansen att möta människor som jag är nyfiken på utifrån deras historia, kunskap eller erfarenheter. Människor som jag inspireras av och förhoppningsvis kan vi med det inspirera er. Och om ni gillar avsnittet får ni jättegärna dela det så fler får chansen att lyssna. Och det ger mig också möjligheten att få spridning på podden så att jag kan fortsätta länge att bjuda in människor till roliga och intressanta samtal. Glöm inte att du också kan gå in och prenumerera eller följa podden så missar du inte när avsnittet släpps. Den här veckan så är jag på Maldiverna och jag har yogaklasser på ön Suneva Forsi. Och tidigare veckan så släpptes ett avsnitt med en av grundarna, nämligen svenskan Eva Malmström Shivdasani. Och jag tog även chansen att prata med hennes man Sonny som hon har startat den här hotellkedjan med. Och jag valde att dela upp samtalen så att det blir ett avsnitt på svenska och ett på engelska. Och Sonny, han ska berätta ännu mer om deras miljöprojekt som också delar av världen får ta del av. Men Sonny, han är en riktig visionär. Eva beskriver det som att det är han som gasar på med massa idéer och hon är realistisk och bromsar när det behövs. Han berättar bland annat om hur de har lyckats på den här lilla ön att återvinna 90% av allt skräp, om hur de har kunnat hjälpa 800 000 människor runt om i världen att få rent dricksvatten. De gör en liten förändring i deras business som gör en stor förändring för världen, vilket jag tycker är så inspirerande att lite kan göra stor skillnad.
So thank you so much, Sonny, for being part of my podcast, and thank you for having me here.
Right. It's a pleasure, Kristen. Welcome to Suneva Forsi, and you're very welcome. And thank you for the honor.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's beautiful to be back after 18 years.
I didn't realize that long.
Yeah, it was 18 years.
And so, you came with your mother last time, did you?
No, I was here with my ex-husband. He was doing a travel show for Sweden.
Right.
And I was pregnant then with the youngest one, and the oldest one was 6.
I see. Oh, yeah. No, fantastic.
But now he's 24 and 17. Right, yeah. So it's going to be fun to show them around.
Yes. No, it's evolved a lot, the resort. We believe in continuously evolving, improving, developing, but we've kept the same fabric and the same spirit.
I could really recognize myself when I came back.
Right, yes.
And also that all the houses are so hidden.
Yeah.
So I can't see that you have built a lot on the island.
Right, yeah.
Because you can't see the houses.
Quite a lot is upgrade to existing buildings, and some of the building is actually enhancing the island in terms of more trees, more plants, permaculture techniques to enrich the soil so that the plants thrive and grow better. So, we're continuously evolving. There's always, it's this idea of mastery, continuing to improve oneself all the time. One never quite gets to perfection.
No, so, but it's for us... who comes over here, because you own Suneva is Sonu and Eva.
That's right.
Put together, and you own, and you also the one that you know taking care of. Otherwise, it's normally when you have a hotel, maybe someone is taking care of the hotel and keep the business,
right.
and another owner.
Right.
But
yes.
You are both.
We're deliberately both the owner and operator, and that was a deliberate strategy, and that's why we sold Six Senses. So we founded a company called Six Senses, which has grown quite rapidly and has many more properties. And that was through managing other people's hotels. And so in 2012, Ave and I realized that firstly, our job description was changing. Mine was, at least I was spending too much time going to hotel conferences, meeting investors, looking at budgets, getting budgets across the line. And all we could manage to do when you're managing someone else's hotel is to ensure that the next hotel is as good as the last. And Ava and I are very much about continuously improving, evolving, and developing. So I really wanted to spend my time on developing new strategies. It could be a host engagement strategy that would have more engaged hosts, so you have that magical service. Or it could be a restaurant concept or even a new resort concept. I wanted to spend my time on that rather than just going to conferences and meeting investors and trying to grow the business. And I also felt that luxury has become institutional. If you consider, one could be in one of the top streets in Stockholm or Bond Street in London, and you'll see these names of people who once passionate about a watch or making a watch or jewelry or handbag or luggage. And all these names are now owned by two or three big groups. And you see it in the hotels as well. There's rapid consolidation in the hospitality industry with these big chains owning more and more brands. And the funny thing is that they're expanding through managing other people's hotels. They're not the owner. So the owners of the hotels are usually institutions, sovereign wealth funds, private equity funds, listed property companies. And their sole objective is to maximize shareholder return. So there's no one really thinking about a brand in terms of having an idea, having a philosophy, and driving that through. And so by being both the owner and operator, it allows us to have strong beliefs. And in fact, my title as CEO is Guardian of the Culture. So on my business card, it says Guardian of the Culture, and then in brackets, CEO and Joint Creative Director. But
yeah, because you call yourself guardians instead of owners.
Right, we do as well.
And so beautiful.
Of our islands as well. Yeah, so Ava and I do feel that we're guardians of these islands because we'll only live a lifetime. We don't have children. So this is for us, it's really, what can we do in our lifetime to leave the world better than when we arrived? And that's our legacy. Our children are all our hosts. We try and develop them and hope that they will develop great careers. And we've had some amazing stories with some of our hosts. One of our former hosts, our former financial controller, now runs a small hotel management company here in the Maldives with six hotels and two more under development. Another one, a canteen chef who was running the kitchen off our construction when we opened in 95. He went back to Sri Lanka and we said, we'll buy prawns from you because we needed a sustainable source of river prawns. Traditionally, the problem with prawn farming is it's not terribly sustainable, quite toxic. And so he said, if you can find prawns that are sustainable, we'll buy from you. And he's now one of the biggest traders supplying prawns to the Maldives and he has two hotels. So it's nice to see some of our hosts evolve and develop and we feel they're like our children. But in terms of coming back to the point of guardian of the culture, I believe as the CEO, as the leader of the organization, my prime job is to create values and beliefs and a philosophy, create a culture that will drive behavior. So we even have language. There are 500 words in the Suneva dictionary. So every 6 months, we'll have our strategic meetings, but we call 2 days of it the energizer. So rather than everyone sitting around looking at PowerPoints, someone just spending all day making presentations and other people just listening to them, we have the energizer where I come up with topics, I'll set the context, and then we'll be in groups of eight and there'll be small brainstormings and then we'll try and drive ideas. And 1 hour at the end with a glass of champagne is to develop new Suneva language that reflects our values. So for example, when you arrive on the island, you're greeted by a host, not an employee. You can imagine coming to an island with 450 employees or this island with 450 hosts. The whole experience is different for the guests because our hosts are behaving like hosts, not like employees. And it's those little things that drive changes. And so,
yeah, I think because what I appreciate is that you the small things that makes a big change.
Right.
I mean, it's a small island, but you do a big change over all over the world. And you can also see it on the island.
Yeah.
And it's the funny part because we're going to talk about the different projects that you have, thinking about the nature and taking care of it. But Eva said that green for you from the beginning was just a color.
She's so rude. No. So Eva, of course, being Swedish and in the 70s and 80s, the Swedes were already very green compared with Britain, as an example of a former EU member state. So I lived in Oxford in the 80s, and we had the impact of Thatcherism, a lot of development, and you'd see these beautiful bits of countryside turning into industrial estates or housing estates. It was quite tragic, you know, because the Oxfordshire countryside is very beautiful, and Maggie Thatcher at the time was driving economic development and pushing the economy. She was very slightly on the right side of the spectrum, political spectrum. And so we saw that. And then, of course, James Lovelock was talking about Gaia, and the first discussions of global warming were discussed by scientists then. So as a university student, you read up a lot about it. And then we arrive here in the Maldives, which is a beautiful environment. And that's what blew Ava and I, at least me. First time I came here, I put my head under the water snorkeling. It was incredible. Just literally a couple of meters from the resort, you'd have these incredible clumps of coral with vibrant live fish. It's not quite so good now because we've had obviously coral death, but that's what blew me away. And so we were in this pristine environment, and we were clear that the attraction of this destination was its beauty, its nature. And so we had to preserve the beauty and the nature, including the vegetation, so enhance it. So in terms of development, you'll see many more trees and much thicker vegetation than perhaps we had 20 years ago, because we wanted to enhance it. We have many more varieties of vegetables and salads and fruit, which we've developed that support.
Yeah, you have your gardens here on the island.
Exactly, support our guests with nutrition. Yeah. Nothing better than that. We have a permaculturalist whose sole speciality is the symbiotic relationship of plants. She's an aerial permaculturist. She's a great expert in how plants work together. So so we had to protect the environment. That was obvious at the beginning. And it started very much with conservation, just building around the trees, changing our architecture to fit the vegetation.
Yeah, because you can tell in one of the bathrooms, our bathroom, it's in the backyard, and then it's a tree in the middle.
Right, yes.
And then I've been talking to Eva, I just smiling. It's not because it's really beautiful, it's standing in the middle, but also that you're not taking the bigger trees down.
Yeah.
And if you cut the trees here, the small ones, you plant new ones.
Right, of course. Yeah, many more. Considerably more. And then we recycle over 90% of our waste is recycled. So the cardboard and the food turns into compost. We then take the branches that fall off the trees. We put it into a pyrolysis oven, and we turn it into charcoal, making our own coconut oil. But a lot of these things, like the pyrolysis oven, apart from making charcoal, it creates a biochar, a black soil that enriches our vegetable gardens. The compost obviously enriches our vegetable gardens, but it also helps with the vegetation. So when we see some plants or trees in the jungle not faring too well, we sort of enrich the soil around them with our waste. So we call it waste to wealth.
When you're running bikes around the island and then suddenly you see a sign, it says waste to wealth.
Yes.
And I just have to tell the listeners, this is not a big island.
Right.
Because so many that you have your waste to wealth and you have the glass area, and it's like it's amazing. I was doing the paddle boat around the island and it took me 1 hour.
That's very fit. Good.
So it's not that so it's not that big.
Right.
But you do have so many that you have your own garden, and then you also have the like 70 villas.
70 units, that's right.
Yeah, units, yeah.
Ranging from 1 to 8 bedroom houses. We've been selling houses.
Exactly. Over the years, yeah. But when I was paddling around, I could hardly see the houses from the water.
Yeah.
And there is so many different things when you find you can just tell like through the bushes, like something is behind there, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So it's really nice covered up. So you do fit in. But also with this, the glass you were talking about, because it was when you decided not to also bring the water in to the drinking water.
To ban branded water, yeah.
Exactly. Mm. So what did you do to make your own water?
So we studied it because we realized that other hotels were competing with water menus, and it became very fashionable in middle of the 2000s. So you'd go to a Four Seasons or some of these luxury brands or these luxury restaurants, and you have a choice of 10, 20, 30 waters. And I thought it was crazy. water. And the funny thing, the irony of it is that half the bottled water sold in the world is tap water. So the biggest supplier is a company called Dasani. It's a brand of Coca-Cola. And most of their water is tap water in these terrible plastic bottles. So we felt that this was so against our values and beliefs that we had to make a statement to the opposite. And especially when you have 1 billion people that don't have access to clean water, we thought it was a disgrace. You can imagine that bottle of Fiji water. It could start as a bit of oil in Alaska, and it shipped down to the Gulf of Mexico, the oil. into a refinery and turned into petrochemicals. That petrochemical is then shipped to a factory in Fiji to turn into a water bottle. They then take that water, they put it in the bottle. It sits on a dock for about 2 months. We know that plastics are carcinogen. So you can imagine it sitting on that hot dock. It then goes on a hot boat all the way across the Maldives. It ends up in a store for another 2 months. It then ends up on a guest table. It fills their glass. They drink it. By then, it's pretty toxic. Any Fiji water and health image or dream of fresh water from Fiji is completely gone. It spent 6 months in heat with this plastic, and then it ends up in a garbage dump. It's a terrible example of a linear process. And we said, well, from extraction to manufacturing to production, consumption, waste, you know, we've got to get out of that. So we said we have to create a closed loop. So we studied, we found people who could clean and treat the water. We desalinate our water anyway. So all the water from the showers and, you know, in the taps you can drink, you can brush your teeth with. But for pure drinking water, we wanted to make it that much more cleaner and then add some minerals. We did a bit of research. We studied Masaru Emoto, a Japanese philosopher who believes that words affect water crystals. So under a microscope, he has water molecules. And he says words like love, and they look like an object in the Cartier catalog. And then he says hate, and they completely disintegrate the look. And you can do the same with music. So we play classical music in our water bottling plant. And then our water menu is 6 jugs, and each jug has a different healing crystal from VitaJoule. So that's our thing. So it's a nicer tabletop appearance. You have these beautiful jugs. It's very healthy because we've added our minerals. It's fresh. It hasn't been exposed to plastic. It's much more ecological. And importantly, it's financially more advantageous. So our cost of water went from 20% of water revenues down to 2%.
Wow.
We saved 18% that of our water revenues by not buying the Evian Vitel and just serving tap water, which we then enriched and enhanced. And that 18% has given 800,000 people access to free water around the world because, you know, we didn't want to make a profit on that saving. So we gave it to water charities over the years.
So the 18% then, you gave it away.
To water charities, yeah. And it's given 800,000 people access to clean water. So a small change to the way we do business. It did not affect our profitability or the way guests perceived us in a negative way. In fact, I think it improved that perception. But it went a long way to impact people well beyond our shores and also just improve our practices in terms of making our practices more sound.
That is so interesting because that's what you always say. It's like a small change could be, if we do it together, it will be even bigger. But also that on this little island, you create your new ideas about doing things.
Yeah.
And then it affects so many places around the world.
It does. You know, throwing these stones in the pond and creating ripples. That's what we felt with our sustainability journey over the years. We have felt that quite often that's what we're doing. We're obviously, our impact's not going to change the world. But if people see what we're doing and they copy, that may. So what we did do is after a few years, and especially when we sold Six Senses, we focused much more on the Maldives, our activities more on the Maldives over the last few years. We realized that a lot of our Soneva Foundation money, so that water money.
Yeah, because you have a Soneva Foundation.
That's right, yes. So just to backtrack a bit, we were talking about values and philosophy and beliefs. As a role, my role as the guardian of the culture is to drive these philosophies and values. And by being the owner and operator, we can have that consistency. And that philosophy is this idea of slow life. Imaginative and engaging slow life, offering our guests luxuries, minimizing our impact on the planet and enhancing their health. That's what we mean by slow life. So luxury, wellness and sustainability, they aren't opposites. They work together. And you can ask, how do we do that? You know, how do we combine these opposites? Because traditionally people would say, well, if it's sustainable, it definitely isn't luxury. And so that's not what we communicate to our guests. That's our internal foundation. If you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, the pyramid, the base for us is slow life. And then the top of the pyramid is this idea of inspiring a lifetime of rare experiences for our guests. But in between, how do we do that? We use this phrase, intelligent luxury. It's important to be creative, but creativity needs structure. It needs a railway track that drives that engine of enthusiasm. And so our railway track that drives our creativity, this guiding principle, is that word intelligent luxury, looking at the Latin origin of intelligent, intellego, to try and understand what luxury is about. Because people say gold and marble's luxury. No, luxury is essentially that which is rare to you. So you as an individual, that which is new, but it's true. It's something that rings a chord in your heart when you touch it or experience it. And we need to realize that for our guests today, most of our guests today are urban. They're self-made. They're living in cities. And they don't have some of the things that the successful took for granted in the past. In the past, a lot of the successful and the wealthy and privileged were the landed gentry, living in the countryside, fresh air, fresh food, space, privacy. Today, our guests don't have that. They're living in a city. Fresh air and fresh food are rare and at a premium. Space and privacy is almost impossible. So when they come to our resorts, that's what's rare to them. We take your shoes off and we put in a shoe bag which says no news, no shoes, and you walk barefoot. Now, the simple gesture like that, you know, putting in a shoe bag, has a huge impact. So firstly, walking barefoot is grounding. The electrons of the ground support your body. There are various studies on it. There are so many acupuncture points, meridians, that end up in the root of the foot. So you're giving yourself a continuous massage. So it's known to lower blood pressure, stimulate.
So you're thinking through everything. Yes. It's so much fun to hear. Right.
And then, of course, if you are barefoot, you're going to want open air spaces. You're going to want sandy floors, not air-conditioned marbled restaurants. And so that's a more sustainable option as well. That salad was plucked fresh from the garden. For people living in urban context, that's much more luxurious than the foie gras or the caviar or whatever else.
Yeah, so
you can
really
get that in London
or
Paris.
What luxury is for people. It's yeah. different for
it's what's everyone. Rare.
Yeah, yeah, it's rare. Yeah. That's true. But also you, I saw the in the film, it was the pot, the cutlery pot that you... have made for people in...
Cook stoves.
Tell me about that.
So back in 2008, the World Travel and Tourism Council, which is the private sector government partnership, they met in Dubai and they gave us their Tourism for Tomorrow Award, which is the equivalent of the Oscars for sustainability in travel and tourism. So we feel very proud to have won it twice. And they were launching their carbon calculator. So I went back after that. I told our group conscience, Arnfin, and I said, let's study it. You know, they're launching this. We need to find out what they're doing. We've won their award. We need to be an exemplar. So he looked at it and he said, look, unfortunately, it's not enough because it only covers scopes one and two. What happens on your property, such as that light bulb or energy or the buggy or et cetera, the generator, it doesn't cover externalities. And that's the key thing. Is we've got to cover the externalities of our carbon footprint, such as flying supplies in or shipping supplies in, flying guests in. So we started measuring all of that, even to the last detail, whether we were serving beef or chicken or whether that beef came from Australia where it was free grazing or, say, Argentina where deforestation might have been involved. So our team created a very complex model. We put all that data in, including our guest flights. So what we do is we know where they're coming because we have the arrival flight details. So all of that data is put in. And then we have a 2% carbon levy. So we decided, we calculated that and we found out that 85% of the CO2 emissions as a result of our being were scope 3, which people don't measure. So we then introduced a mandatory, not voluntary, mandatory carbon levy. So when we quote you for the room, it's 10% service charge. There's 12% GST, local GST, and then there's a 2% carbon levy. If you book through a tour operator, then we absorb it ourselves because the tour operators get a net rate. And that has given about $8 to $9 million over the last 10 years for the Sneva Foundation. It funded a 1.5 megawatt windmill in India, 500,000 trees in Thailand, supporting the local community there. And then in Darfur and Myanmar, the cook stove, because 4 million people die a year of lung asphyxiation. They're using firewood just to keep warm, purify their water, or just cook their food. And they're in these small houses, and the smoke is impacting on their lungs. And they eventually die of sort of breathing issues. So we introduced these cook stoves. There's a they clean, so it's subsidized. So we don't give it free because people don't use things that are free. So we buy it for $40 and we sell it for 10. And they clean air, so clean stove, so no smog, no smoky air anymore. 50% reduction in the wood consumption, which is important because in Darfur they're risking the security of their villages just to find the firewood. And in Myanmar, some families that we support are spending up to 30% of their income on firewood. So now they spend half of that, so only 15%. And then a 60% reduction in CO2 emissions. So a small change again to the way we do business. It didn't affect our profitability. Guests didn't look at it badly. It was 2% on the room revenue. No one objected. Whenever people ask, they just want to know where the money's going and what we're doing with it. And that's it. And but it had a huge impact for people well beyond our shore. So that's really what's driven the Suneva Foundation, is this idea that governments create the context, but we as companies need to make the change.
So what do you think if you should get, inspire other companies to do things for the environment? Because there is a lot of change and it takes time to change. But what they can do, I mean, just like the plastic reduction, Eva told me that you find plastic now and then. Yeah. And but now you start to make this lamp.
I don't know. Have you been to Eco Centro yet, our Waste to Wealth Centre?
No, I'm going there.
Oh, you should. Okay.
But I didn't know that I could go in.
Oh, you so can. We'll organise a tour. Just ask your barefoot buffer.
Okay, okay.
We'll organise it. So,
and then I'm going to take pictures and I will put that on Instagram for the listeners. So it's listening now. So I will show you how it looks in there.
So like Glassicle with the glass, we're doing the same with aluminium and plastic. Mm. So we still have little Coke cans sometimes and then little tops for bottles. We bring in aluminium from other resorts and other islands. And we make objects. So at Suneva Jani, our little hooks, the knobs, little works of art. Kevin, our artist. You should go and see Kevin, our Christensen.
Because I met Kevin.
He's making things between aluminium, wood. Plastic, sort of combining things. Which is quite nice, and using
that's
these
the
three
artist,
mediums.
Who's on the island at the moment.
Yeah, Kevin. He runs Glassicle. Yeah,
And I as come back to this with the inspire other companies, because when you can tell when you walk into the bathroom, you can find your own bottles where the text is on already. The and it said sun protection.
Yes.
Not what did it say? Not destroying the coral.
Yes, that's right. So our sun cream, exactly. Yeah, so sun creams can affect the coral.
Exactly.
And our coral is very fragile generally. So we have a huge challenge. If we can't carry on as we are, by 2030, 90% of coral would have died. So,
yeah, imagine if they could have in all different countries that kind of protection, and each business along the beaches took that responsibility, that will make a big change. So that's what I was thinking of. Do you have any ideas for other companies doing business to make that small change to actually affect the world?
Yeah, I think better? Every company has its own context. So I can't comment on specifics for one company or another. I can give examples of what we've done in the hospitality industry, banning branded water. We've never had toiletries and plastic bottles. It's absurd. You go to a hotel and you have a Bulgari or an Acqua di Parma little plastic tube. It annoys the hell out of me because I'm not going to take a little bit of shampoo or shower gel and then have the housekeeping throw that plastic thing away. So I put it in my toilet bag. So, and then I use that for the next couple of hotels, but I always have to, I have to have a plastic bag to put it in. It's annoying. Whereas if it was a nice ceramic container, I'd just take a little bit that I need for my shower and then be on my way and not have to pack bit of plastic thing, throughout my trip. And are people really going to check into a Four Seasons because they have Acqua di Parma and Asprey's rather than their homemade product? I've spoken with hoteliers for the last 20 years, and I just think it's absurd that they still believe that that's the case. It's just completely crazy. And I think it's just a lack of ability to change. So those are examples that we've done in our industry, banning branded water, giving the savings to water charities, measuring all three scopes of carbon. We're a seasonal business. So when we have low occupancy and periods we know we're never going to fill and there's no risk of displacing any paying business, we give holidays to auction off for charity. So I think every year $2 or $3 million is raised from the holidays that we've given. But, you know, they can only come, the people who buy the auction lot can only come during June, July, where we're empty anyway. I mean, June is a very, very quiet month. So it's nice to have some guests. They're at least paying for the food. So just thinking about ways that you can make changes to the way you do business that doesn't affect your profitability or the way guests think about you. Because obviously
And also, as you say, when you reduce your 18%, not taking it yourself, you're giving it away.
Right, yeah.
And because it's easy that they maybe keep it themselves and do something in their own business instead of bringing it to charity.
Yeah. The good thing is that I think the world is changing. Mm. There is much more conscious capitalism.
Why I'm so happy to talk to you, because you can really tell, if you look at the website and you see the beautiful island and the luxury resort and everything, but it's so many things behind it as well that you couldn't hardly understand. So if you're listening, go into the website and also go and see what kind of charity that you actually do, because there is
the
so many.
The Foundation,
Foundation and the Soneva Namoni and stuff. It says about that in your website, just to know that we all can do something, and we need to do it together.
And what I would like to say to other organizations is I've always said personally that a company must have a purpose beyond simply enriching shareholders like Ava and I and our partners and paying employees a salary. And when you can do that, it can be very engaging and have a lot of meaning. And in the 21st century, if you're not doing that, I don't think you'll survive as a corporate, because the young generations, the X and the Ys and so on, they want to work for companies that make them feel good, that give them a sense of purpose, where they feel that when they're going to work, they're doing something beyond just helping themselves, helping people beyond. I think we all want to do that deep down, and that's what really inspires and drives us. And it engages them. Mm. And having engaged employees is one of the key jobs of the CEO of an organization. You want people who come to work 100% engaged, passionate about what they're doing. I read the study where in the US, Gallup have this survey on engagement. They have 16 questions, and something like 20% of employees in American companies are fully engaged. Only 20%.
20%.
It's very low. It's
very
terrible.
Low.
Yeah.
I was talking to one of the hosts here, and he actually said to me, "I recognize you." Mm. And he has not been to Sweden, so he doesn't recognize me from there. But then I said, well, I've been here once, but that was 18 years ago.
Yeah.
And he said, "What year?" And I said, 2003. Well, I started working here when I was in 2002.
Right.
And I was like, "You've been here for so many years."
Yeah.
And then you also recognize me. That is really impressive. And it means also that you really love where you're working.
Right, yeah.
Because he was so passionate,
right? Yeah,
about the place, and he was talking. It was the guy that has his father is the fisherman.
Oh yes, Rocket, our fisherman.
Yeah,
okay.
The son of.
Was he a butler or a waiter?
He was a waiter.
Okay, that's Shafiq. Oh, Shafiq. Okay. His son, his father is Rocket. So Rocket's been supplying us fish since the construction time.
So he was the son,
and he has two children. One's Shafiq, who's a waiter. Maruf is a senior butler.
Okay. Yeah. I met him out on the blue.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so
funny.
It was really nice. And then I was talking to Jonas Björkman, that the staff or the host, as you say, you really care about them.
Yeah.
And that is also important, even though you say that they should feel, passionate about what they're doing and feel that they do, like, they can make a change for other people.
Yeah.
But you also care a lot about them.
Right.
Yeah.
We do. I mean, it's very important as an organization to have a sense of love and friendship and bond amongst everyone. I mean, that's what creates efficient teams.
Yeah. Eva said it's not like climbing up a level. We all are on the same level together.
Right, yes. We have our spheres of influence, yes.
Yeah. That's
rather than the corporate structure. So, yeah.
Beautiful.
I always tell the story about the typical corporate ladder. It's like a tree full of monkeys. So, you know, you look up and you see arseholes, and you look down, you see smiling faces. So we definitely didn't want to do that. So that's why we created these spheres. So you have three spheres. So, well, you have the core. We like to follow patterns of nature to lead our organization. And so we have the core, which is myself and the key team members, the chief commercial officer, the CFO, et cetera, the C-suite, as they call it normally. And then we have the inner sphere, which is like the general manager, executive, housekeeper, chef, etc., the properties. And then you have the dynamosphere, which is the middle management that taking the strategy of the inner sphere and supporting the atmosphere with it. And then you have the people who are creating the experience, which are the atmosphere, which are the waiters and the chefs and you know, the butlers, etc.
You make everything so beautifully.
Thank you. But we think through some of the things we do, because in a way, that's what drives a successful organization, is having a strong culture, strong values, beliefs, and a philosophy that sort of engages our hosts. So I mean, that's my message to other company CEOs, is try and have a purpose, a genuine purpose. And it's got to be authentic, and everyone's got to believe it. And so in our C-suite, our core, our chief commercial officer is vegan. Because firstly, she doesn't want to harm animals. And secondly, she realizes that meat is damaging the environment, and our beef industry for terrible. I mean, after the built environment is going to be sorted out through alternatives to cement and better production there. But after that, it's the cow. You know, cows account for 20% of global warming, dairy and beef. And that's why we've dramatically reduced consumption of dairy and beef, both from a health point of view perspective, and also from a sustainability point of view. Our CFO runs a sustainability team. He was in the city, did very well in the city as in the investment community in the solar industry. Had a fund, and he was managing a fund, and then he had an NGO before he joined us. He was an enthusiast, and so a lot of our C-suite are quite passionate about this whole thing of sustainability and our mission, and then that runs through out the organization. And I think that's very important for companies, because if you have a purpose that rings true with your employees and they believe it's authentic, you're then going to drive true engagement and better results. Mm. Engage people, drive better results. You know, if 20%, only 80% of your employees are not engaged in what they're doing, you're not going to be standing out from the competition for sure. So I think that's a message. Yeah. And then I gave some examples of what we're doing in our industry. Mm. And I think others can think of, you know, ideas based on the same principles. So.
So what do you think about the future then?
The future?
For Soneva. Soneva Fushi, and you have Soneva Yani. Do you have any other?
Our future at Soneva.
Yeah, your plan. Future.
So we love the Maldives. You know, we've been living here. We like the environment. We're very comfortable with the destination. It's a very successful luxury resort destination. So we want to do a bit more here. So we're starting on a project in November, which is, it's like a secret. It's about 80 miles north of here, quite remote, few rooms, few villas. That will open in 2023, summer of 2023, and we'll announce it closer to the time. And then we want to do a wellness center, which is dedicated just for wellness, a destination spa. So that's our next projects here. We like Japan. We're working on...
So a wellness center on a new island?
On a new island. Yeah, and it'll just be like it'll be like a retreat, like Shivasom and Canyon Ranch. So we've just about to launch Soneva Seoul. Mid-November, we launched Soneva Seoul. We've taken over the Six Senses spas here at Soneva Fushi, Soneva Yani. We've been running it since the beginning, and we've now expanded the spas, and we call it Soneva Seoul. And so it takes my 25 years of experience with wellness, combined with my recent history. I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer back in October 2018, and I sort of took a couple of weeks out. The doctor wanted, I was in the University College London Hospital. He wanted to hospitalize me the next morning and not travel for a month and 6 months. Sorry, not travel for 6 months and not leave the hospital for a month. And I said, well, how long have I had this? And he said, most probably it started about 18 months ago. I said, well, 3 weeks isn't going to be a big issue. So he gave me some steroids and I spent 3 weeks researching on it. I ended up in Turkey because what I found was they could, because it was stage 4, I needed to do the chemo. But what I found, it was oncologists that were open-minded to alternatives as well. So in addition to the chemo, I had hypothermia. We were in a hot box because cancer cells die about 43 degrees. So for an hour and a half, you're in a hot box at 46 degrees and you're drinking water, lots of water, sweating a lot. They're managing your pulse and then they wrap you up for an hour. This is whilst they're giving you the chemo. So of course, if you did that in the West and I died and Ava had sued the hospital, they'd have been dead for doing these things, because it wasn't the protocol. It wasn't subject to detailed clinical trials. I then have hyperbaric oxygen in the morning, vitamin B12, IV vitamin C, antioxidants. So lots of complementary things. And that experience sort of gave me so much more learning about wellness that I didn't have after 25 years of sort of founding Six Senses and running
that. So they
that.
Could tell then after you've done this heating treatment or the
well, after
the
6 weeks from stage four, we did an X-ray because I discovered it with an X-ray. I could hardly breathe. So there was a 9 centimeter by 5 centimeter tumor that had collapsed a lung. The other lung was, you know, on its way, and my aorta was being strangled by other tumors. I had about 30 tumors in my chest. And I didn't want to do another PET scan after 6 weeks because it's quite toxic. You have to drink this radioactive liquid and you put in this machine. It's really noisy for about 50 minutes. So I only wanted to do that at the end of the 6 cycles. But I was going to do the 6 cycles anyway, whatever I'd read. And that's the nice thing about Google. You can read a lot.
Yeah.
So I, with all that research, I couldn't find any research that said I shouldn't do the 6 cycles of chemo. There was research about radiation, so I didn't do that. And so I was going to do that. So I did the PET scan right at the end. But after 6 weeks, I did the X-ray and it had all gone. There was just a light shade. And the doctor said, that's obviously at the carcass of the tumor. And everything else had disappeared. So it showed that it worked. And it was all the complementary things as well as that. And I just realized from my own experience, even whilst I had the cancer, you know, once I knew I had the cancer, I was diagnosed, I realized what had happened. And even during the 3 to 6 months before, I knew that when I misbehaved in terms of food and diet, I'd find it difficult to breathe. And then when I behaved well, I would have no problems breathing from a food and diet. So I realized how food, diet, what we do had huge impact.
And stress.
Yeah. And so Soneva Soul is going to add that. So you'll have your standard relaxing treatments and the beauty that most resort spas have, but they'll go with a bit more depth. Thousands of years of ancient Ayurvedic wisdom. In between my chemos, I'd come here for 10 days and do mini panchakarma. So we had an Ayurvedic doctor and 2 nurses, and I'd do the oils and the cleanse so then I could go back to Turkey. I fasted for 2 days, the benefits of fasting. So I had no negative impact from the chemo. The first time I did it was like swallowing metal. I had no appetite for 8 days. I was very weak. The next time I did it, Tuesday, you know, the chemo, Wednesday, I took only 600 calories. I slept quite long. And then the Thursday morning, I was in the gym. Evening, Ava and I were celebrating in a nice restaurant in Istanbul. And I was fine. So the fasting helped. And those principles of fasting, intermittent fasting. So Ayurvedic doctors, traditional Chinese medicine, biomodulation, extreme heat, like hypothermia, hyperbaric oxygen, cryotherapy, extreme cold.
Learned a lot.
Yes, exactly. So all of these things we're going to add to Soneva Soul. And so we're doing that in our resorts. And then we'll have a destination spa where people go for the cure for a week. And that will just be a bit more intense. There'll be 100 guest rooms. We'll make sure we have 150 guests in-house when we're full. And about 100 therapists and practitioners with 100 treatment rooms and most probably 400 treatments a day, because most people will be doing 3-4 treatments a day. So
so your ideas, as Eva says, that they comes and pops up all the time,
right?
And in the couple, as you are doing this together, she says that she's kind of the break now and then, and you kind of speed on with all your ideas,
right?
So that's your focus now, to combine it with the more wellness and health.
Even more
than you already do.
Yeah, that's right. So we're doing more in the Maldives. And then with Soneva Soul, we'll be doing these in resorts, like our own resorts. We might do some third parties. And then we'll have a dedicated Soneva Soul in a couple of years here in the Maldives. In addition to that, we're very keen on Japan. So we're working on a couple of projects there. Okinawa.
How come Japan?
Tokyo. I just love the country. It's such a civilized culture. Have you been to Japan?
No, I haven't. But I just recently read a book about Ikigai.
Ikigai, exactly. Yeah. Following one's passion. And
exactly.
And you see the Japanese. I mean, sushi is incredible. Have you been to our sushi restaurant here?
Which one is that?
It's a 6-seater. It's just 6 seats.
No, I haven't been there.
I see. Oh, yeah, you should go. It's in Out of the Blue. It's just where the teppanyaki is, just below
It's there.
Yeah, but, and you'll see Akira. And Akira just epitomizes. You can't get sushi like that outside Japan. It's very rare. And he just epitomizes, you know, that whole experience just epitomizes the attention in Japan, the attention to detail with the ingredients. So Ikajima is how you kill the fish with dignity. So, you know, you fish the fish up, and normally fishermen, they leave it flapping on the deck. Of course, all the adrenaline is excreted. The flesh is undermined by the stress hormones from the fish as it's struggling and dying. Whereas with Japanese, they realize that. So before the fish even lands on the deck, they have a bolt, they put it through the eye, the fish is dead. They then just cut the spine like this and cut off the tail. And that means that the flesh isn't undermined. So you'll see fish that just taste so different to what you have normally. You have to try.
Yeah.
And then 25 years, you can't serve sushi in Japan at that level, at that omakase professional level with this, you know, small 6-seater. You can't do that. You wouldn't be allowed to do that in Japan if you hadn't studied for 15 years.
That's like amazing.
Being a lawyer and a doctor combined. It's such an art. And they're very rare, these people. So you should definitely try it before you go.
Yeah, I need to try that one. And I'm digging down to this ikigai because I think it's really interesting in what you do in life and what the meaning, your meaning in life. And that's what you can do in the bigger perspective and do for others, what the world needs as well.
Yes, no, and it's very important. That's a part of it. Yeah.
I can talk to you forever.
Yeah,
because
I know.
I have so much to learn from you. And this is so interesting because it's kind of in my...
Right.
My area where we
must have run out of time,
yes. No, but I'm thinking of you going for lunch now. Thank you so much. And I think that I will still play the Aerosmith because this is a part of, I made like two parts of this episode because since some people listen to, it's hard for Swedish people always, not always, but sometimes to listen in English. So we have Eva and then we take, this is the second part.
Okay, very good. Perfect.
So then we play Aerosmith.
Excellent.
Yes.
Good.
Perfect. Thank you so much,
Pleasure.
Sally.
Thank you, Kristen. Bye.
I nästa veckas avsnitt träffar jag sångerskan Titti Sjöblom, dotter till artisten Alice Babs. Hon har nyss kommit ut med en bok som heter Född i rampljuset. Hon har en lång karriär och har spelat in stenplattor och till idag uppleva Spotify. Hon var med i Melodifestivalen samma år som ABBA 1974. Hon har jobbat med de stora artisterna både i Sverige och i världen. Men hon har alltid också valt sin egen väg. Ett underbart samtal om teknikens utveckling inom musik och underhållning. Om att bli jämförd med sin mamma. Om hur hon alltid valt att lyssna på sin intuition och hennes enorma kärlek till musiken och till publiken. Missa inte nästa veckas avsnitt.
Den här podcasten är producerad av Perfect Day Media.